I was watching a TikTok last night. Yeah, judge me all you want. But I was watching
Chinese propaganda.
This Utah girl, and she's like, when you move to Utah, you have to say it like this. Like the instead of four, you say fur. And you might say shiz or my heck, you know, like, so there's all these dialect things. And in fact, when you hear, when I hear that a person from Utah talk, sometimes it's like nails on a chalkboard to me.
Yes. I call it sugary sweet. Mm-hmm. There's something about it that's just sugary sweet. And they drop the endings like tramp instead of trampoline or gunna.
Yeah. So there's little things. So Sean being from North Idaho. Mm-hmm.
But born in Utah.
Born in Utah, but spent most of your time, your developmental years in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
I would be willing to bet if you were to gather a group of people, a consensus of that region, and you get together with them, you'll start to identify, you'll find, and you don't even know this, but psychologically, I shouldn't say psychologically, it'd be more like
subconsciously,
you have more of an affinity towards these people because you're hearing something that you grew up with. Uh-huh. And it's spoken in a way that it's like home to you.
Yeah.
So you have an affinity towards like those
home
people.
Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
That's interesting because there's a lot of these apps out there or even just, I don't know if they're apps, but they're little tests on the web that you can go and it'll give you a series of words and it says, what word would you use for this, like a soft drink? Would you use soda? Would you call it pop? You know, so on and so forth. And they go through a variation of these things. And then you go through it, and it's only like it's 20 words or something like that. It's not very many. And you select those words, and it'll tell you what region you grew up in. And it is accurate.
Spot on.
And the thing is, I feel like I talk like my wife. I feel like that we use the same vocabulary. And it had her as Southwest, the Southwest, but not like a conservative area of the Southwest.
Oh, wow.
And it had me of Northern Utah to Idaho. I was like, oh my goodness. It was like spot on.
Yeah.
So yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think it's fascinating. I think it's pretty cool how you can identify with people in a spoken way without using words. It's the tone of your voice, the timbre, the way you go up, you go down.
Yep.
And it's all regional.
I like to throw the nasally part in there. Yeah. I think it...
French in you, yes.
No, it's the professor in me.
Oh, okay.
The Bueller.
Yes. That is a little, you are a little bit nasally.
I am a little nasally.
Yeah.
You're stuffed up.
No, I'm... I feel pretty good.
Thank you.
Thanks for clearing that up.
Sniff that up.
Get a good whiff.
The clientele that we have appreciate my nasally voice because when their hearing is going out, I think it really
cuts through
and it helps them understand. And I do make a conscientious effort to enunciate my words, but it's the nasalness is not conscientious. It's just natural.
Right.
But I think it pierces that sound barrier and it gets right to the heart of it.
Right.
Personally, I'm a mumbler. Like I want to naturally mumble.
Yeah.
And over time I've tried to correct it, but like if you found me in my native, in the wild state, I would most likely not open my mouth when I'm talking because I don't know. I don't know why.
Backyard working on a project.
So I like to mumble. How has the speech therapy played into your marriage, this new marriage with Chris? Do you feel like you can psychoanalyze him?
Do you?
With the speech therapy?
Yeah, using speech things.
Because isn't that a thing with like psychiatrists and psychologists? It's like you're never supposed to evaluate your spouse.
Yeah.
Isn't that like a thing? Isn't that like a rule?
Well, I get accused of psychoanalyzing people all the time.
Okay.
That would actually have been my dream job.
Not speech.
No, it's actually my dream. That would be my dream job. So I got into speech.
I think they call that judging in the Bible. But I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm not a biblical scholar.
No, I'm just fascinated by, you know, like how you grew up you know, dictates how you perceive things, how you perceive yourself, how you, you know, what birth order were you in the home?
Can you demonstrate a little bit of it?
What do you mean?
Dushan.
Yeah.
Dushan. Uh-huh. Where did you grow up, Sean?
I grew up, so I was born in Salt Lake City, grew up there till I was 8 years old, and then I moved to northern Idaho, Sandpoint, Idaho, which is an hour south of the Canadian border.
Secluded in the forest.
And in Idaho, you know, there is two groups of people. There are the people that live in town, and they're very, very liberal. And then there are the people that support the town and actually provide all of the means of, you know, services.
He's telling you stuff without telling you stuff.
And those are the loggers. Those are the people that work in the mills. Those are the individuals that go out and make sure the water sources.
Right. So you grew up more out of town.
I grew up out of town. So I was one of those guys. And yeah, I did feel like a bit of an outsider. I grew up in a big family in a trailer home, a nice trailer home. It's double wide. But nonetheless,
yeah, those out there, manufacture. Yeah. It was something I know about you is that you enjoy your naps, and that you.
How did that even come into that? Nothing to do.
Wait,
with
let her do her thing.
Doing my thing.
Let her do her thing.
That because you need to recharge. Because socially, this is just what I've observed.
Okay.
You can only take so much socially. Like, and I'm so that I recharge.
You see me kind of declining.
Yes, physically, and I do the same thing. I'm an introvert naturally, and so I recharge alone. Is my time alone. I have to gear up. Like I was telling Martine, I was sick
yesterday.
Yeah. And part of that was the worry about coming here. Cause I leave all the social stuff to Chris cause he's very good at it. And so for me, I have to prep myself to, I have to
mentally
be in the right
aware.
Mentally. Uh-huh. I have to be right in the right mood. You know, I have to tell myself, like, say we're going to a business thing for Chris. I ask Chris, who's going to be there, and tell me a little about them, because I need to prep myself about questions to ask because it doesn't come naturally to me, you know? And so I know that about you, and I, going back to the cycle, and then that partly probably because you grew up like that with a lot of peace, a lot of quiet, things were slow moving, and so you don't like that chaos. You like that time alone.
It's interesting. We had a guest on, David Ibarra, a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying when he was growing up, there was only 15 channels, and, you know, we chuckled because now there's infinite amount of channels. But when I was growing up, there was like two.
Yeah.
A third would come in sometimes. And it was like only if you had like the tinfoil on the rabbit ears just right. And so a lot of times it was just daytime TV, like soap operas. And I never had any interest in that. So I'd go outside and we would, you know, figure out something to do.
Right.
And it's true. I get overwhelmed pretty quickly when I'm in large groups.
Yeah.
And I've just got to get out. When I went through college, and I'm a sociology minor.
Okay.
I learned that people that come from the country, they get like stimulus overload very quickly when they go into the city, because individuals who grow up in the city learn what to turn off.
Right.
And so they don't see all the lights, and they don't see all of the, you know, the traffic and hear all the noise and the hustle and bustle that's going around them. They've turned it off. They've deadened their senses to that. Whereas a country boy hasn't learned to do that. So it's all coming in and bombarding him. And that was me. I remember the first time I went to New York City, my brother-in-law took us to Times Square and we ate at the ESPN zone. And I was just like, he was talking to me, and then he was like, Sean, are you there? I'm like, what? What did you say? And he's like, I just asked you a question. Like, how was your trip?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't hear anything. Like, there was so much bombarding me that I was just like stuck deer in a headlight. Someone could have just like slapped me in the face, and I'm like, what's going on?
Right. But part of that, too, I think is personality as well, you know? So it's kind of where you grew up.
I'm just a little dumb. I'm a little slower. I get it.
I think you're slower. No, but like, Chris and I are very opposite in that way. Like, he likes to be connected all the time with everybody. You know, he's on his phone, he's texting, and I'm just, you know, and he meets with his friends a couple times a week, you know, and I feel like I'm good alone. I'm good to do my own thing and to, you know, I have good friends that are close friends, but I'm cool if we talk to each other once every couple weeks, mm-hmm. you know, and he's the opposite. He's always knows what's going on and likes to be involved. And so it's been an adjustment in that way.
I know he's going to listen to this, so we mm-hmm. should psychoanalyze him right now. So I'm, as you're talking, I'm thinking, so does Chris need that because... Is it a way that he feels validation or like worth? Like, if the more he stays connected and is responding or communicating or has these friends that are speaking back to him, does that help him feel like of worth? Or
I don't know if that's necessarily Chris. You know, I in a sense, except that it just interests him. But maybe I think mm-hmm. maybe there's for anybody. I think anybody that posts, you know, or stays connected in that way, there's something that they're getting, a validation that they're getting.
Dopamine hit.
Yeah, especially a dopamine hit.
And I'm the opposite. And he gets mad at me because he sees my phone and I have thousands of unread messages and that drives him nuts. I'm like,
yes.
Why does that drive you nuts? I don't get it.
Yeah.
I care less, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. He feels like texting is a genuine form of communication.
And we've I was like, well, this discussion.
Yes, yeah. Like, and I'm just like, but you don't know what somebody's doing when you text them. Right. Like, I think it's terribly rude to be at the table and be on your phone answering a text.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so if you're texting me and I don't get back to you right away, you need to assume, you don't assume that you're not important. You know, but you assume that I may be busy doing something, you know, and I mean, it was fantastic when we were dating because he was very responsive and that was very rare, but, you know, in dating people, you know, he was very, you know, in tune and we communicated all throughout the day because we lived apart while we were engaged and then got married and I moved here. But and so it's great, you know, but so to him, you know, he feels like that's. Yeah, like when I text you, it's because I need an answer. I'm like, and I feel like if you need an answer, you need to call me.
Yeah.
You know, and but he feels like texting is a genuine form of, it's legit and it should be, you know, important.
Well, what are some tips so I can be better like Chris then in responding? So like, how does he, because I have my phone on vibrate.
Well, I think it's distracting.
I don't even know how to turn that off. It's just on vibrate all the time.
It's just on vibrate, right.
I don't know how to turn my ringtone on and I don't want to.
Right.
You don't know how to turn your ringtone.
I've tried. Push the buttons on the side, like all the way up. It doesn't work. I don't have time.
This is
to
a guy that's
out.
Got a that's robot right. with his own AI program in his garage.
He knows how to figure it out. I just think it's distracting. I think if you.
Does he have a watch that tells him, hey, no. you're getting a text? Do you, he just,
no, he just
feels it in his
pocket. He feels it. And then he has the phone on there, which is great. You can get a hold of him anytime. And I know if he doesn't text me back, it's because he's in a meeting. But I feel like it's distracting. Like, how do you get anything done if you're constantly, mm-hmm. you know?
We went to a conference. This is years ago now. Remember that at the very end, we went to some class. I mean, we have to do this all the time. We have to go today. But
continuing education for lawyers.
Yes. Yeah, and we had to
make,
do that.
Make sure that we're sharp and on our game, yeah. serving society, keeping justice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That aside, this one was on more like the management of the practice, and it showed studies of like employees with their phones, mm-hmm. just having their phone in front of them mm-hmm. on the desk, just it lighting up,
mm-hmm.
them not even interacting with them. It takes them on average 20 minutes to get back on task.
Right.
Just
right.
from looking down and seeing yeah. that light up. Now, if they look down, grab it and text back. Now it's like 45 minutes to get back on
right,
task.
Right, right.
And that's happening
all the time. I know Chris in his office, he does deep focus. And so they'll turn mm-hmm. off all the phones and stuff and not, so they get stuff done because it's distracting. To. Yeah, it's distracting.
See, I just do that all the time.
You just turn off, yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell Chris that.
But he enjoys it and think of all the things that he knows because he's constantly.
No, he's a fan. He's so awesome. There. He's a renaissance man.
I see that you have a Twisted Sugar mug.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about Twisted Sugar.
It is a soda cookie shop. They're very popular in Utah and Idaho. And we actually had the friends, I don't remember if you remember the Straleys that used to live here.
Mm-hmm.
She approached me probably 2 or 3 years ago and just said they wanted to start this Twisted Sugar here and they just wanted a silent partner. And I was like, perfect, because she wanted to be able to have something to do, you know, with her time, because all our kids were back in school. And so we looked into it and started moving forward. And then she moved to Colorado. And so... So I wouldn't say we got stuck with it because we didn't really have anything going yet, but we just liked the idea of, Chris is always looking for investments.
Yeah.
We have nothing like that here. And so we just thought it would be a good thing.
So describe what Twisted Sugar is.
Twisted Sugar, they do kind of, it's kind of like a combination of Sonic and Crumble Cookie, I guess, if you will, but I feel like our cookies are better.
Mm-hmm.
So they have different varieties of cookies.
I thought they were actually Crumble Cookies.
No.
Oh.
No, we have our own recipes.
Okay.
That the original owner came up with our own their own recipes. So when we bought the franchise, I got access to all those recipes.
And you've been practicing them.
I have. I have not had any training, so I'm excited to have the training from them to know how to get them the right size and everything, but and then they do like specialty sodas, and so you can get like Diet Coke with coconut cream and lime in it, or stuff with raspberry. I know they do like things called refreshers, so people that are a little more health conscious, it's like coconut water with fresh fruit, and you can make it sparkling or sparkling. So yeah, some of the other stores are starting to sell coffee and like do ice cream with it, but I don't know if we'll do that.
Ice cream. I'm all about that.
All about the ice cream. I know we have the local shop, the Moo, something Moo.
Yeah.
So I think Chris thought about approaching maybe them about being in there, because we know it's a franchise, but we want to support local businesses as well. And so.
And you're going to, so you've already got a site established, and it's right across from the Dairy Queen off of Avenue B and 26?
Like, yeah, 26, I think. No, it would be more
other way,
like
22nd.
22 or 20th.
Yeah, 20th Street.
20th Street, yeah.
So there's a Dairy Queen. The Dairy Queens are always packed. They always have cars coming out of the parking lot. So is your parking lot going to be adequate for your customers, or are you going to have a stream of cars coming out into the street?
No, it should be. And then the way the building is designed, the drive-through will wrap around the back. So our Twisted Sugar will be on the end where the drive-through is.
Mm-hmm.
My husband's building a, I don't know what you call it, just like a little strip mall thing there. So there'll be space available to lease. And so, it will go drive through around the back. So it'll have the whole length of that building. I don't know what the square footage of that building is, but.
And you're looking to lease it to like other food locations, like food destinations?
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to be very picky about it.
Mm-hmm.
So about what goes in there for sure. So it could be, you know, dentist's office or just whatever goes in there, other food places. So, and I think he has a. What's that? Memory.
A photographic.
Photographic memory.
He's a savant.
Something like that. Because he can read anything. Yeah. He can, you know, and so that's why I leave the social stuff to him, because chances are he's read something about it. I'm good for how are you? How are your children?
Yeah.
You know, and then I want to move to the deep stuff because I don't remember. I don't remember, like, we've traveled a ton and been lots of places, but I couldn't tell you what we saw while we were there.
I'm interested more in how you grew up. I want to psychoanalyze you.
It's not about Chris, it's about you.
So tell me about your background.
So I'm the second oldest of five children. When I was really little, my dad was in the Air Force. So I was born in Alabama, and then we moved to Okinawa, Japan. And actually my parents were there very shortly after Doc Cook was there.
Okay.
In Okinawa, Japan. So we have
so
that
we're talking about the orthodontist,
yes.
Dr. John Cook.
Dad.
Yes, dad.
Yeah, he's since retired, but yeah. We've had him I don't know if we've had him on our show, but yeah. we've had Jeff Cook several times on our show.
Yes. Yeah. So his dad, they were there the same time. And then my dad got out of the Air Force and we moved to Clearfield, Utah, where there's an Air Force base right there.
About where about?
North of Salt Lake.
Clearfield is a little north of Ogden.
Oh, okay.
So it's right. There's a Air Force base there. Hill Air Force Base is there. So we lived there. My dad got out of the military and finished school because he couldn't get a job as a pilot, I guess, back then in the
really
early 80s. There were no pilot jobs. And so he went back to school and we were poor as dirt. Both of my parents, when they talked.
Interesting, because you think pilot, you think that's a pretty good
living. Well, but he wasn't a pilot.
No, so, but he had the training and the skill and the.
But they weren't hiring back then. So I don't know who was the president.
There's a university there, right? Ogden has, isn't that Utah?
Ogden
State?
Has Utah, University of Utah is in Ogden, I believe. So he went back to school and my parents were just struggling. And so I have been. My dad's cousin that lived in Central Valley, California, was looking for another insurance agent. And so then we moved to California when I was 7. And I grew up there, beautiful place, lots of fresh produce. You know, we grew up with strawberry stands on the side of the road. You get peaches and nectarines and stuff.
Kind of like
so
here as far as
very
that
much,
ag, right?
Yeah, very much like here. So that's why it wasn't a big shock when I moved here. So then I did high school there and went away. Terrible student. I'm a terrible, terrible student. That's probably part of my memory issue. But it's BYU Idaho now there for 2 years. And I studied. My first was I was a music major because I wanted to be a music therapist. So what type of
instruments do you play?
Played the piano since I was 4, and I was kind of over that. So when I went, I was a voice major.
So you're singing in the choir.
I want to hear you sing.
So I cannot sing, so I had my...
Where's the guitar? Where's the guitar, Martin?
I had my thyroid removed, and I can't sing, so thanks for bringing up a...
Nice job.
No, I'm
Adam's
kidding.
Always good for that.
I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
You could if you wanted to.
I just don't have the range or the control anymore. But I wanted to be a speech or a
voice,
a music therapist. I imagined myself, you know, on the floor in the hospital in my flowy skirt.
Oh yeah.
Seeing people. So I guess I've always, they go and
that's cool.
So when I was a speech therapist, there were people that could not, because of their cognitive issues, they couldn't talk to you, but they could sing like primary songs and stuff because that part of their memory was still intact. So I think I always liked
that's
therapy.
That's incredible to me.
Yeah. So I did that, but I couldn't pass the theory classes. So then I switched to a nutrition major and I couldn't pass the, so I was a terrible student. So I went and I said, what can I graduate? Because at the time it was only a 2-year school.
Why do you think that was?
I wanted to be a mom and a wife. And so I just couldn't imagine what I didn't want to be a teacher.
You're on the hunt.
Yeah.
You're on the prowl.
Well, I just didn't have an interest.
Always got to take the dark side.
Why? She was single, ready to mingle.
That's right. That's what interested me. It didn't interest me any type of work. But I graduated in family and religious sciences, but I went to the wrong building and walked with the interior design majors. And that basically sums up my college
experience. Do you have an eye for interior design like you have an aptitude toward cooking?
No, I am not visually, I cannot visualize things. So most of the decor in our house is Chris, because I've never met a man that cares as much about the inside of the house,
The outside, of it, the aesthetics of it all.
He just sees
it.
He's an artist and he has a vision. So, So I met my late husband in my last semester there, and we got married in 1994 is when we got married. And then I just worked odd jobs to put him through school. He graduated, he was an optometrist. Graduated in 2003, I believe, and was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer in 2004.
An optometrist, your dad, you know, in all likelihood, he should have been a well-to-do pilot for a commercial airline, but your family struggled. Your husband should have been a very well-to-do optometrist. They do very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, he passed away. So it just seems like your lot in life that you are not to have a lot of money, right?
Well, my dad did very well in the insurance industry.
Did he? Oh, okay,
so once we moved to California, he did very well. So I definitely did not grow up. We were definitely upper middle class. So, and I don't think I really knew how well he did until I was much older, because they lived very conservatively. He used to always say his secretaries had nicer houses than we did, because he just didn't spend it. You know, it wasn't cheap, but he was just very, you know, and so now they've been able to retire and go on to missions. And
your parents are both alive and well.
They are serving their second mission. So they're in Austin, Texas for 6 months. So their first mission was in Lake Oswego, Oregon.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And
where are you going with your story, though? You were...
Well, it's just... I feel like we were about to make a connection there. Because if my parents worked very hard, were very industrious, but it just wasn't our lot in life to have the nicer things, the luxuries in life. And I just kind of got used to that. That is it. It's never going to happen for me. I would say in the past 10 years, the practice has done well, but I feel now like a fish out of water. I feel like this isn't me.
Yeah.
The other shoe is going to fall pretty quickly, and the rug is going to be yanked out from underneath me. I talk to Adam all the time about that I don't feel comfortable in my settings right now, because I feel comfortable living paycheck to paycheck, scraping by.
Right. And I think I definitely relate to the waiting for the other shoe to fall, for sure, because of that. So, yeah, working so hard and then having my husband pass away, you know, you're just right there. Because he passed away the year after he graduated from optometry school. So we didn't even, we were able to buy a home, you know. So when he got diagnosed, we were supposed to do an internship because he was going to go work for an ophthalmologist, buy into that practice. And he didn't get the internship, which was not like him at all. He was a very hard worker and was often first picked or picked over other people, you know, because he worked so hard. And so it was weird. So he ended up working for an ophthalmologist for a while. And then when that guy, because he was going to reapply the next year. And when that guy found out he had cancer, he added him to his group insurance, you know? And so we had two, because we had our own family policy. So that was back when we had both insurances, didn't recognize the other. So they paid for all of his stuff 100%, you know? So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
You have children, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I have two children. I have a son that's 20. Going to be 28 this year.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's 21. So yeah. And then two stepchildren, Chris's daughters.
How old were the kids when
my
this
husband,
all happened?
My son was 7 and my daughter was 3. So it was shocking.
So you raised them for 13 years, you say?
Mm-hmm. So I had to go back to school because I had only gotten my associates at BYU Idaho. And so I went back to school and then
you were
my master's.
You were there at the time in like the Ogden area?
So in Central California. Before we moved, my husband wanted to do an internship in Alaska, you know, and we're a religious family, so we were prayed about it. And he said, besides going on a mission, this was the second time he had ever had such a strong impression to do something, and that was to move us back where my parents and so when he passed away, I had that support.
That's what I was getting
around.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so that way, I mean, we were getting ready to have. I wanted to get pregnant again, and we were just kind of had this uneasy feeling, like no, we should wait. And then he got diagnosed, and he fought it for about 18 months, but it was stage 4 when they.
So despite all of the trials that you've been through in life, tell me a little bit about how you've seen God's hand play a role.
I know we don't like the cliche of tender mercies, but
I do.
Yeah.
I think you just explained one right there. I was just going to say, it looks like, and I'm sure it was very hard at the time when you're in it to see it, but now years have passed and, and time has a way of bringing clarity. And looking back now, you can see even in tragedy, God's hand was putting you, was just, he was surrounding you.
Right. With his love. Well, I was, I always grew up very faithful to our religion. I was a very good girl, did all the right things. And so I think I took for granted, you know, the, that God was in my life and helping. And that was definitely a time when I felt him there. I remember almost like it was almost a year exactly. I had this feeling of like this separation. And you know that, that poem, Footsteps in the Sand or something, Footprints in the Sand. And so I felt this separation, like Heavenly Father basically saying, okay, you're going to be okay now. And so knowing that whole time I was being carried, carried during that hard time, you know, I think that's when I felt him the most. And then, like I told you, what a horrible student I was. And so I had to finish my undergrad. And by some miracle, there were like 200 applicants for grad school and they only accepted 20. And I don't know how I got in, you know, and that. And then when you get done with your schooling, you have to take this big exam. And I had to go to my oral exams for all four parts of it. And just the help from the professors to get me through that, because I'm not a good student. I don't remember things, but I was a great clinician, I think, because I connected with the kids and I kind of had a sixth sense about what they needed and how to get the things I needed from them. But book smarts are not really my thing. So I think in that way, I think, really big testimony about waiting on God, you know, for the timing of things, because I dated a ton, you know, before, during that time. When my kids were really little, I was very on the sly, you know, just talking to people and phone calls, and I would take little trips, you know, to go meet somebody, but never brought kids around them, never brought somebody around my kids till they were old enough for me to say, I'm just dating, you know, mom is single, so she's dating, but I can't remember where I was going with that. And so when I met Chris, I can't think of a more perfect person or situation, you know, to be in. And the timing. So just knowing that if you wait on God, it's going to happen when it's supposed to happen. And you'll have all these little things that...
Yeah, and you look back at all of like your experience going through school, and a lot of times what you thought it was for wasn't at all what it was for, the career aspect of it, the money-making aspect of it, but just learning more about yourself, learning how to have compassion for people that have struggles that we may not even be aware of in society in general. As we go about our lives, that there's individuals that are just, their whole life is consumed with they're not able to speak clearly to others. I recently read a book to my kids. We have this tradition that I'll read a chapter book to them when they go to bed. And this one was called The Paper Boy, and he was a stutterer. And so it's his basic novel of what he went through as a stutterer and how difficult he had to like pre-think everything he was going to say beforehand and what words he was going to use for that communication, because he was going to avoid all the hard words that he couldn't say. And he would make it very short, very concise. And then if somebody came back with, you know, well, what about this? And it was like, oh, that would throw him for a loop.
Right.
And that's something we totally take for granted every day. But and that's just one tiny sliver of a subset of society that struggles with things. And you got to have your eyes wide open to that.
I think what I noticed the most was how the disadvantage that's out there, you know, they say, well, anybody with hard work and, you know, everybody has the same opportunities. And growing up in upper middle class and, you know, I just thought that, you know, I've just thought, no, everybody, I mean, my first husband grew up very poor on a farm. And so I saw that he, you know, everything he ever had was
pulled himself up by his bootstraps.
Yes, and was always worked hard and bought his own things and, you know, stuff. And so that was always my understanding. But it's not really true, because some of these kids have such disadvantage, and not necessarily because of economically, but just how their family is, you know, single moms and, you know, parents that aren't home, or abuse that's happening, or, you know, just they can't see the opportunities because they have no support at home. And so I saw in grade school which kids were going to probably be in jail. You know, like, you can see that. And that's, I think
I'm laughing at that, but
yeah, but that you can see that. And so you just really have a compassion for people, and they need some extra help and they need some extra support.
This plays into a question that I was going to ask a lot earlier, but now that we're here, and if you don't want to answer it, it's okay. But your kids had the experience at a young age, such tragedy, right? With your first husband passing away. Did you as a mom ever feel like they're ruined? Like, there's no way they're ever going to have a normal life or childhood now?
I wish that I would have thought that then, but I didn't. I didn't think that then.
Why do you wish you would have thought that?
Because I would have done a better job. I think because I was alone, and it was obviously depressing at times, and I was very distracted because I was in school. And you know, when you're that unhappy, sometimes you have to find things that distract you. And so I feel like I was a good mom, but I wish I would have just recognized, you know, that they had great stability, we had lots of family around them. But I think I just would have just been more present, I think, was the big thing. And part of it I had no control over, because I had to go back to school, you know. But just because I'm somebody that recharges alone and stuff, you know, when you're a single working mom, you don't really have those things. And then it's all on you all the time. And so there were definitely times that I shut off and shut down that I think damaged them in a sense, in a way. I know my son would be completely different because his dad had all of the things that he needed, is what I feel like. I feel like his dad was, because he was outdoorsy. Instead, you know, my son ended up getting into video games and things, and, you know, and my first husband was very chatty in that way, and I'm not super chatty, you know. I live a lot in my head and I'm kind of self-contained. And in fact, when we would drive in the car, I would put my son up in the front, because my husband was really good at, look at this and look at that, and do you know that this is how they grow this, and this is what this tractor does. And they chatted a lot, you know, and I was more quiet and kept to myself. And so I feel like he needed the outdoorsiness. And then of course a daughter needs a dad to make, you know, helps them with their confidence, and that relationship between a dad and his daughter is really important. And she was very close to my dad, you know, but it was just different. It was different. So I think more now. I didn't think about it.
That leads to the other question that I want to ask is, do you think that we are a product or a victim of our childhood?
A product, I think, is a better, because I don't like the victim mentality. I don't think that, I mean, you need to take what's happened to you and own what's happened to you and feel all the feels, but then you still have a choice in your life on how to react to it. Like me, I had a choice, you know, how to react in that situation of losing my husband. And so, but absolutely, absolutely how you grow up. Even you probably see that in your marriages, you know, the dynamics that your parents had together, you often adopt those, you know, and either go far against them, or you know, you kind of repeat that same thing. So,
yeah, I think you're onto something. The reason I bring it's top of mind to me, because I just had a conversation with my wife about this. And there was somebody that she had been chatting with, and they were telling her how horrible of a childhood that they had, and and all these things, and that's why they do this, that, or the other. And and so I was, the thought occurred to me, that sounds like a victim to me.
Yeah. You know?
Like, you hear, you have your kids that are thriving, you know, and they came from this tragic circumstance. Yeah. So, and you see people thrive when they come from the worst of the worst circumstances. Right. So what sets a person, how does that happen? You know, I guess is the question is, how can that be duplicated where you have success stories coming from the most tragic issues or circumstances. And then you have our kids growing up in really good circumstances that end up being horrible people when they grow up.
You know? I think it is that victim. And I think it's personal accountability, you know, by looking at yourself and saying, okay, these are the things I can't change, but these are the things I can change. Like, I can't change what my childhood's like if you had a bad childhood, you know, but I can choose to get therapy to overcome some of the things that, you know, hey, how I may react in a situation, or my perception's huge. You know, you're either, you know, pooped on all the time, or you have the best charmed life, you know, but that's perception. You know, you're even having the worst day or the best day, but that's perception. At some point you have to look for the positive and
the glass half.
Yeah. And that, I think, as I was having a conversation with a friend about that, I think at some point you have to choose to make that shift. I'm like, cause self-talk, you can either be somebody that's always down and critical of everything and critical of everybody, or you can be somebody that's positive and happy. And I think at some point you have to make that change and it becomes a habit, you know? So even if it feels unnatural at first, like the gratitude journals or picking five things at the end of the day that worked good, even if that feels unnatural at the time, I think the more you do it, the more it'll become habit as opposed to the other way. But that's a choice at some point.
So now that you've said all that, looking back, would you change anything? Would you change the hard things that happened?
I would say yes, just because of the way it affected my kids, you know. But would I change the lessons that I've learned? No. I think I learned at a very young age what is important. You know, I mean, it's why Chris and I have such a great marriage now, I think, because we lost our spouses. And so the fact that he doesn't pick up his clothes, you know, or that I'm forgetful, or sometimes that I'm messy, you know, those things don't matter, because being alone is so terrible. And, you know, and just, you just appreciate that they're there and companionship. And
you, Sean,
what?
Appreciate your companionship with Brittany.
Probably not as much as I should.
Yeah. Dude,
that was way too slow.
That was way, you better edit that out.
Well, but because you guys,
he's gonna fix that in post.
No, she's talking about, you know, how much she appreciates it. And of course, she gained that appreciation through this drought of having a relationship, whereas I've always been in a relationship for all of my adult life. I've been in this relationship. And so I can't appreciate it the way you appreciate it.
Well, but then the other thing, though, is you're a completely different person in your 30s and 40s than you are in your 20s. You know, so who's to say that Chris and I aren't better matched up than maybe I was with my first husband? You know, who's to say that that's also not part of it?
Yeah.
You know, for that, for sure. Do I have time for a bathroom break?
If we're done.
Oh, we're done? Okay.
Yeah, we can be done if you want.
We're an hour and 10 minutes in.
Oh, wow.
45-minute show.
Oh, cool. I didn't get to talk about my dream job, which is kind of what we were...
Oh, well, go then take a bathroom break.
No, it's okay.
Go take a bathroom break, because the first 15 minutes I already know is junk, so...
No, it's totally fine. We could be done. I'm ready to be done.
Because I wasn't here.
That's okay. We kind of touched on it anyway.
What's your dream job?
We'll have you and Chris come in and talk about it.
Oh, that'd be fun. No. No, it would just be like a sex therapist is my dream job, actually.
Really?
So. I want to get into this, Sean.
Wow.
No. Yeah, now you...
next time.
Perked up. No pun intended.
Yeah, that's actually what my daughter's doing. That's what...
Really?
Really?
Yeah, that's what she's going into. She's at UVU.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have. I know the time went fast. Thank you for listening to another episode of Life, Death, and the Law. We'll be back next week.